Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama rejects the Keystone Pipeline deal for now. Top internet sites protest anti-piracy bills in Congress, and then there were four. Who's up, who's down, and who's out in the Republican race for the presidency? Joining us for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, and Ryan Grimm of the Huffington Post. I hope you'll join us as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jerry Seib, let me start with you. We learned yesterday that Rick Perry suspended his campaign. Now, what does that mean?
It means he's done, and it means that his supporters, which haven't been all that plentiful, are up for grabs. It also means, and I think this may be in the long run just as important, his money is up for grabs. And I think you're going to see a divergence there. You get the sense that a lot of Rick Perry supporters may head toward Newt Gingrich, as Rick Perry himself did, but that the big money behind him is more likely to head toward Mitt Romney. So I think in South Carolina terms, it's kind of a wash because he wasn't gaining traction there. Maybe a marginal benefit to Newt Gingrich. In the long run, may actually be beneficial to Mitt Romney to have more establishment Republican support galvanizing behind him.
Cheryl, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think the big question right now, obviously, in the Republican Party is who will emerge as the conservative alternative to Mitt Romney. So the question is, do Perry supporters go to Gingrich or to Rick Santorum? Now, he's urged them to go to Gingrich, and we see Gingrich already rising in the polls in South Carolina, with some analysts predicting that he will beat Mitt Romney there on Saturday. In the end, frankly, I don't think endorsements per se mean that much. I think maybe it will help him right now at this moment. But also, clearly, Diane, we've seen the Perry endorsement way overshadowed by the controversy over Marianne Gingrich's statement that her former husband Newt asked her to have an open marriage when they got their divorce 12 years ago.
Ryan Grimm, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What was your reaction to that first question by John King?
You know, he probably didn't handle it the best way that he could when Gingrich came after him. If John King had said, and just to back up, he asked him about the open marriage to launch the debate, and Newt Gingrich said, "This is appalling and borderline despicable that you would even do this."
And attack the media. Yeah.
And John King said, "Well, don't blame me. It was ABC that first reported it." And he kind of looked like he'd been smacked around by Newt Gingrich. If he instead would have said, "No, you have for decades been running as a principled, family values conservative. How is that not relevant? How is your own personal behavior not relevant to your politics?" Then it might have put Newt Gingrich back a little bit.
Jerry Seib.
Well, I think it was clearly a tactical response by Newt Gingrich. He was going to respond to the question by attacking the question itself and the questioner, and that was what he did, and he did it very effectively. You know, I think a reasonable response would have been, well, it's not the media, it's your former wife that has said this, so respond to that, not to me. But, in the heat of the debate, and this has been a feature of Republican Party debates increasingly, the respondents are playing not just to the TV audience, but to the audience in the hall. And that's clearly what he did. He got a standing ovation. That changes the dynamic of the debate. It changes the way it feels in the room, and that, by extension, changes the way it looks on television.
If I could change one thing about these debates, it would be to ask the audience to be silent. It not only affects what's happening inside that auditorium, it affects everything. It changes everything. I think it's unfair to the country as a whole to have to sit through these cheers or boos or whatever, Cheryl?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think that the audience participation in these debates has been one of the most fascinating phenomena of the whole cycle. But also, with respect to Newt Gingrich, attacking the media is a tactic that we have seen from him throughout this cycle. He began, you may remember the debate where he told Chris Wallace, stop asking gotcha questions. He criticized Maria Bartiromo of NBC and said, you know, the media was not asking legitimate questions on the economy. He eviscerated Juan Williams the other night at another debate when Juan Williams asked him were his comments about child labor laws belittling the poor. And we saw him literally just take down John King last night. So he's an excellent debater, but he also has learned that attacking the media plays well to a Republican audience, and particularly the crowds in these halls.
Right.
But on the other hand, if these crowds are representative of the Republican primary electorate, then maybe it is useful to see how they respond to certain questions. It's probably interesting for the American public to see them cheer, for example, a person who doesn't have health insurance and is left to die, as they did one time, or boo a question from a gay soldier about gay marriage. You know, that kind of does bring the issue then to the center stage and say, well, why as a society are we treating people in this way?
It's a good point, Cheryl.
Yes, although I think that it's a self-selecting society, right? I mean, the people who go to these debates are really they're partisans, right? So we're seeing sort of a core of, I think, the most partisan element of the Republican Party. I do wonder how the rest of the public reacted last night, especially to Newt Gingrich's treatment of John King. Let's face it, you know, there are a lot of women out there who would probably like to know the answer to the question, who would like to hear more, who perhaps watched Marianne Gingrich's interview and are wondering about Newt Gingrich's marriage to her. And you know, perhaps we're just not hearing those voices.
Well, you know, it cuts a lot of different ways. I mean, I was one of the moderators for the Monday night debate, and in that case, it was not just the audience cheering or booing the moderators, but it was also a case in which Ron Paul got booed by people in the audience. So it just creates a much different atmosphere. I'm not sure what's right and what's wrong. And you're right, Cheryl, by definition, it's a small and self-selected audience of people who are actually going to show up for that sort of thing. It just does change the dynamic, and I think it makes for good TV, but I'm not sure, you know, whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing.
And what about Iowa? Rick Santorum now claims victory there. How does that change the dynamic, Jerry?
I don't think all that much. I mean, you know, the truth is nobody knows, and oddly, I don't think anybody will ever know who really won Iowa and by how much, because somehow 8 precincts votes have been lost.
And how does that affect the importance of Iowa?
Well, that's a question that people will have to debate over the next 4 years. My guess is probably not all that much. I mean, you know, somehow we spend 4 years debating the importance of Iowa and New Hampshire, and people attempt to belittle them and to change the way the system works, and we always end up in exactly the same place. So I'm not sure it really will. Iowa was and is essentially a tie between Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney. In the long run, you have to step back and say that's probably better than Mitt Romney expected to do in Iowa and better than we all thought he would do. We thought he might even skip it entirely. So I don't think it changes all that much.
I want to ask you about Mitt Romney and his attitude, his comments about his money. There seems to be something of a tenure there, Ryan.
Sure, and it's the worst possible time for a private equity executive to be running for president. You know, when you have the American consciousness focused on inequality, of Occupy Wall Street raising the issue, he's clearly a one percenter, and not something that he would deny. And his advisors must just smack their foreheads over and over and over again to casually bet $10,000. To say that you made not very much income from your book sales in 1 year, and it turns out to be, I believe, $374,000.
Speeches as well, Cheryl.
Right. And, you know, other things he said throughout the course of this campaign, corporations are people, jokingly saying, I'm unemployed, and then accusing President Obama of practicing the politics of envy. I think that's a theme that that we're going to see. And the issue about his taxes is really hurting him. He has said he paid an effective 15% tax rate. He hasn't released his tax returns. We know he has made a lot of money. I thought that was the one point on the debate last night where he looked, frankly, kind of squirrely and off his game when John King said to him, will you follow your father's lead and release 12 years of your taxes, which George Romney did when he was running. And Mitt sort of kicked back and said, well, maybe. And, you know, he doesn't seem to know how to handle that issue.
Jerry, how important is a candidate's tax information?
I don't think, per se, it's all that important. I think what is important is the perception. And in other words, does the candidate understand the concerns of average people, which is kind of the way pollsters ask this question. And a lot of things go into that answer. I actually tend to think, and I think the Romney campaign probably also feels this way, that the bigger vulnerability may be the line of attack on Bain Capital, that you spent 20 years plus in the private sector, but you shredded companies and lost jobs, didn't create jobs. That's the one I think they need to push back on, because that goes to the heart of the Romney campaign narrative, which is that jobs and unemployment are the key issue. I know how to create jobs because I did it. If you can undermine that narrative, you've undermined a lot of the case that Mitt Romney makes, that I'm the guy who can win against Barack Obama.
I think that's right, but I also think the taxes will reveal something else that Mitt Romney doesn't really want to talk about, and that's his donations to the Mormon Church. And we know that he tithes, as faithful Mormons do. He gives 10% of his income to the church. 10% of Mitt Romney's income is quite a lot of money, and the tax returns will probably reveal that and would raise it as an issue.
Cheryl K. Stolberg. She's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with Ryan Grimm of the Huffington Post, Cheryl K. Stolberg of the New York Times, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. The phones are open if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Tell me about the economy. It would seem that there are some good numbers out there. Sales of existing homes up 5%. The unemployment benefit applications dropped to 352,000, the lowest in 4 years, Jerry.
Well, I think you're having kind of a slow accumulation of what I would call modestly good economic numbers. The existing home sales number is pretty good, not great. It's actually a little below what some people had thought, but it's a sign of maybe a floor being built under the housing sector. I think the more intriguing one is the jobless claims going down. That means companies aren't laying off employees the way they were a couple of years ago, and that's usually that usually precedes the ramping up process, and we've seen a little of that. And, you know, for President Obama, the key really is the unemployment number, I suppose. And if jobless claims going down presages a slow drop in the unemployment rate, then that's a good thing. You know, the best the president can hope for is that the trend lines are going in the right direction by November, not that the picture will be great. But you look at these numbers and you say, well, maybe the trend lines are turning around and heading in the right direction.
And at the same time, all of the Republican candidates are criticizing President Obama on the Keystone Pipeline rejection, Cheryl.
Well, that's right. You know, President Obama was under a deadline imposed by Congress to make a decision within 60 days from last month, I think December 17th, on this Keystone Pipeline, this controversial project that would build a pipeline from Canada to the Gulf Coast. The president declared this week that the pipeline was not, quote, in the national interest. Now, those are words he was forced to use by the legislation that was passed. He was expected to declare, was it in the national interest or not? This isn't the end of it, though. The White House has made clear that right now it doesn't feel that this pipeline is ready to go. There's more environmental concerns, but it's clear that it will be revisited. The president told Stephen Harper, the prime minister of Canada, that Canada was free to reapply. Some viewed that as quite a slap at Stephen Harper. But nonetheless, the Canadian pipeline company that submitted this application has says it will reapply, and we'll hear more of this.
And find a different route, Ryan.
Exactly. And it's funny, it might not seem like there's a connection between this conversation and the one we were just having about housing, but environmentalists say that if you build this Keystone pipeline, it's game over for global climate change. And if you think about the housing market, it usually gets going in the spring. Housing starts get going when it's warmer out. For a lot of your listeners, spring came early this year. December was an obscenely warm month, and especially in many parts of the Midwest, where we saw more housing starts than average and more proportionally than around the rest of the country. So bizarrely, this warm weather could be playing a part in this uptick in housing starts that
sure.
we're seeing.
Yeah, I think that's right. Also, I probably should have said that this is a really tough issue for the president, because on the one hand, he's got Republicans hammering him, saying he's a job-killing president. And you have supporters of this pipeline saying it could bring as many as 20,000 jobs. On the other hand, you have a president who is committed to the environmental movement and wants to be the green president. And you've got environmentalists saying this pipeline will be disastrous. So he's kind of between a rock and a hard place. And he's wanted simply to put this thing off until after the election. And that is what he initially tried to do. He said prior to that congressional action that he wasn't going to make a decision. Congress forced his hand, I think, by deciding that saying right now it's not in the national interest, he at least leaves himself open to reverse himself, whereas if he had allowed it now, he obviously couldn't undo that.
Jerry, somebody called yesterday as we were talking about the pipeline issues, saying that these jobs would mostly be for pipe fitters and others in that particular field, and that is the lowest unemployment area in the whole construction field, namely that those guys are mostly employed.
Well, that's probably true. I don't know what the numbers would be, but it's logically that's correct and it makes sense. And I'm not sure that the jobs argument is really ultimately the big argument here. I think the big argument is, does the nation invest in these kinds of projects in a way that essentially keeps everybody hooked on fossil fuels for a long time to come? Or is it time for the government to stop supporting these things as a way to kind of compel the country to move elsewhere in its energy future, which creates jobs someplace else?
So
kind of the Obama view, I think.
How much of an issue is this going to be in the election?
Oh, I think it's going to be a huge election. I mean, Republicans have set it up as a big test, not only of job creation, but again, I think that's the secondary argument. The primary argument is, look, we need energy independence. For now, energy independence comes from fossil fuels. We've got way more oil and natural gas within our borders than people realized even 10 years ago. President Obama is standing in the way of taking advantage of that. That's the argument. And the Obama counter is going to be, look, we eventually have to kick our addiction to fossil fuels. There are great prospects out there to go in a different direction. That's what I'm going to do. And the Obama campaign will frame this as a past view of energy versus a future view of energy.
Right.
Right, and Jerry's exactly right that that's how this is being set up. But one of the kind of Alice in Wonderland qualities of this is that you'd be piping in oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast, where tons of it would be exported. You know, this is a global market, and the notion that getting this pipeline up and running is going to have a noticeable impact at the pump is one that might be appealing to politicians, but take a few steps back and it's fantasy.
All right, let's talk about the online piracy legislation moving through Congress. Harry Reid has now postponed a vote on this legislation that was to take place on Tuesday. Explain the legislation to us, Ryan.
Sure, and this is a stunning turn of events. This is a bill that had been pushed mostly by Hollywood and other content creators, aimed at piracy online, not just in the United States, but globally. And its original iteration was quite extreme. It would allow a company to get an injunction that without a hearing the very same day and take a website down. Now, in order to take a website down, it would attack the very infrastructure of the internet. It's called the domain name system, The problem arises because the internet is a series of global connections, right? And as soon as you break that, one user from one country doesn't get the same website that another user from another country gets, you don't have the same internet that we have today. Entrepreneurs who want to then go out and build web companies would be less likely to do so because at a moment's notice, without any warning, they could be taken down.
So you had WikiLeaks shut down on Wednesday. You had Google with a black line through it. What's really at issue here, Cheryl?
Well, you know, I think it's almost new, or it's been cast as new media versus old media, but really it's sort of internet freedom and access versus intellectual property. So I talked to this friend of mine who's a music industry economist yesterday, and he said, look, all this is to try to take down some of these unlicensed and pirated videos and music, et cetera. He said, if you go online and you type in see movies now or watch free movies now, you can come up with websites that will show you where you can download free movies that are in the theaters right now, which is illegal. They're coming from overseas. He said, all we want is the ability to choke this off at the portal, so that if Google has information that website X is showing these movies, Google is supposed to shut it down. Now, but on the other hand, Google is saying, look, the minute you start intervening in our ability to disseminate information, you are on a slippery slope here. And we saw this fight at the debate last night with, interestingly, Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum kind of on opposite sides of this issue.
Well, you know, it's if you're moving into a media world in which not only can you download a movie that was just released 2 days ago in the theaters, and you can do that, and then you can then plug your laptop into your TV and watch it on your big screen TV, you've really changed the economic marketplace for content producers, for people who make movies and TV shows and let's face it, books and all kinds of things. That's the nub of the problem. The interesting thing politically was, as you know, this was headed toward an easy passage, a bipartisan passage in Congress, until the internet providers stood up and started to make noise in the last few weeks. And then the White House shifted the climate by saying a week ago, well, we're not so sure anymore. We're not so sure this is the right way to do it. I think everybody will now fall back and try to come up with a more elegant way to get at the problem, as Cheryl described it, which is, how do you surgically stop this practice without messing up the infrastructure of the internet?
So what does this demonstration say about the power of old-fashioned lobbying versus the power of internet mobilization?
Sure. These are a set of organizations that hadn't flexed their muscle before. Wikipedia, for instance, going down. I was talking to a chief of staff to one of the backers of the bill before it happened, and he said to me, wait a minute, Wikipedia is going to make the evening news, isn't it? And that's when people start paying attention. When it reaches the broader public, we all know about that. But the kind of untold story of what happened is that behind the scenes in the White House, you had two elements working against this bill that hasn't been reported much. The State Department is one, and the national security community is the other. The State Department, they're overriding ethos is internet freedom. It's a huge issue for Hillary Clinton. She goes to China all the time and preaches to them, do not tell search engines what to do. The national security community, meanwhile, once they started to learn what it meant to break the internet, to break this domain name system, they started realizing that it would create all these ways around what the regulators were trying to do, which then makes securing the internet that much more difficult. There's this saying created from John Gilmore, who is an internet pioneer. He said, "The internet interprets censorship as damage and roots around it." And the national security community actually does believe that. So if you try to block information on the internet, that information will find a new way around it. And that's not something that national security folks want. They want to know where it is. They want a secure internet because then they can they want stability.
So what's going to happen to this legislation?
I don't know. I mean, yesterday, some of the supporters in the Senate, Orrin Hatch and Senator Grassley and others, were trying to work a way around this, trying to revise it. Now we're seeing Harry Reid summarily pull it from the floor this morning. My friend on the other side, on the side of Hollywood, thought it was dead. He was almost saying, well, we lost that one. But as Jerry suggested, it may come back in some sort of revised form, although, frankly, this is such a difficult thing to do technically. I don't know how you get around these technological problems that this issue poses.
It was just a rapid erosion of support for the legislation in the last 48 hours. I mean, really stunningly, and in one day, I don't remember, we had the count in our story, but it was more than a dozen people in the House and several senators all turned on a dime and came out against it. So Harry Reid couldn't get it through.
Jerry Seib with the Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Cheryl, let's talk about this insider trading story. Prosecutors in New York unveiled a massive insider trading case Wednesday involving seven individuals. We're talking about amounts like $78 million.
That's right. This is the Manhattan District Attorney, or U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, said that the scheme included one trade that earned a $53 million illegal windfall for the head of this company, Level Global Investors. He described it as a stunning portrait of organized corruption on a grand scale. He talked about a circle of friends who essentially formed a criminal club whose purpose was profit. And, this was really quite an indictment. But, it raises the question, Diane, what about the banks, right? What about the companies that contributed to the financial downfall?
How come we can go after individuals and we can't go
and
after
I think
the
this,
banks?
This is the whole sort of 99%, 1% Occupy Wall Street discussion that we're having. This is fueling a lot of anger that banks whose activity helped create financial disaster in this country, the individuals within those banks are not getting prosecuted. Now, part of it is just that it's cleaner and easier to prosecute insider trading, right? That's something that you can trace to
an
individual.
But it's small potatoes.
Right, but it's an
to...
easy, I think for prosecutors, it's an easier, cleaner line. Jerry probably knows more about this. It's an act of trading that you can trace, whereas finding the activities of individual bankers may be a more difficult act for prosecutors.
Well, look, insider trading is clearly illegal. Doing something really stupid on a grand scale, which is probably what a lot of banks and people in investment houses did in bundling up mortgage securities, probably isn't illegal. That's actually the nub of the problem for the prosecutors. And so one of the criticisms isn't so much that they shouldn't be doing inside trade prosecutions. I don't think people are arguing that. I think they're arguing, well, the resources of the prosecutor's office, particularly the DA's office in Manhattan, are being diverted to this, and they should be pointed in that direction. I'm not sure that if you spent a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of some and looked for some illegal as opposed to, unwise or even immoral activity by banks, you'd actually find it. The question is what went on that was actually illegal as opposed to maybe just wrong or, as I said, stupid. And that's a line prosecutors have to worry about.
Yeah, Jared's formulation is the right one, but the banks want to have it both ways. They want to say, look, we're the smartest guys in the room. Don't worry about this. We're going to allocate capital. Don't burden us with too much regulation. But at the same time, they want to say that, oh, we're pretty stupid. We just didn't see that there was a $7 trillion housing bubble that was founded on fraud. And, everybody has basically accepted as part of the national conversation that this was fraudulent. Now, people will like to blame the borrowers instead and say, oh, the borrowers were, overstating their income. 2005, I actually worked with a broker to try to buy a house, and I asked him what documentation he needed, and he said, oh, don't worry about it. Just state your income. I said, what do you mean state it? Because I had a pretty low income at the time, and he kept telling me, no, that's not enough. So we eventually did.
Did you buy it?
It seemed crazy, and we didn't. And this was 2005, and I could already actually see that things were overheated. So we decided not to buy at that time. But actually, at that time, you had Greenspan and Geithners and others saying there was no housing bubble, which I don't quite understand how regular people could see it at the time, but others couldn't. But so the idea that's the borrower's fault, you're being told by these brokers who are then handing over all of these loans to these banks, which are just seeing a huge increase in the amount of loans going out to people who clearly don't deserve them. Prices are going through the roof. It was clearly based on fraud.
Ryan Grimm, he is Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. When we come back, it's time for your comments, questions, your emails, your tweets. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at Carbonite.com. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. International news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. Time to take your calls. Let's go first to Brett, who's here in Washington. You've been waiting the longest, Brett. You're on the air.
Diane, you're a national treasure. I think Marianne Gingrich is deserving of a little more sympathy than Speaker Gingrich saying that friends, a couple, would be a good witness for what the couple would say in private. I, I guess it's not much of a comment, but I just used to take care of women with multiple sclerosis, and most men leave them. So I just wish that the speaker wouldn't be so, you know, short and so first he told John he wouldn't answer. He didn't want to answer the question, but he would, and he wants to blame the media. Well, I mean, in this internet media age, you can get your information everywhere. I mean, if Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich hate the media, I wish Rush Limbaugh wasn't the only talk show that our armed forces overseas got to hear.
Oh, no, you're wrong about that. The American Forces Network also carries this program. But to the caller's point, number one, I don't think Marianne has or had MS. Am I correct?
She was diagnosed with MS.
Marianne was. Okay, I'm wrong. Go ahead, Ryan.
To the caller's point, if this is going to be a he said, she said between Newt and Marianne, we should acknowledge one thing. Whether or not there was an agreed upon open relationship, Newt has acknowledged that he was acting as if they had an open relationship. He was having a long time affair with his current wife while he was married to his last wife. So it's almost whether or not she agreed to that, or whether he asked for that and she consented to it, or he didn't ask for that, is almost beside the point. The benefit of the doubt has to be with Marianne in that
situation.
All right,
to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling because I was disappointed and somewhat discouraged by the commentator's comment that the fact that Mitt Romney gives 10% of his income to the Mormon Church raises an issue. And I'm going to suggest that it wouldn't raise an issue if she felt that was a positive fact. And I think that regardless of which faith, I think that when people of faith give away 10% of the income, that's a good thing, and it's good for all of us.
Cheryl.
I'd like to say I actually agree with the caller. I myself am a person of faith who makes charitable contributions, and I in no way think that it is a bad thing to make charitable contributions to religious organizations. I only meant to say that Mitt Romney has not wanted to make his Mormon faith an issue in this campaign. Some evangelical Christian voters are concerned about Mormonism. And so to the extent that releasing his tax returns would open up his faith as an issue, that is difficult for him. But certainly in no way did I or do I think that it is bad to give charitable contributions to religious organizations.
Jerry, on that point, how much of a factor is Mitt Romney's Mormonism going to be in this election?
Well, you know, interestingly, not as much as some people thought, and certainly not as much as it was 4 years ago. I mean, there is a kind of a sense that a couple of factors, the reality that this had all been aired and discussed 4 years ago, made it less of an issue this time. And the second reality that there was a second Mormon, John Huntsman, in the race for a long while made it seem less unusual, I guess. There is it's kind of a lingering question in South Carolina, where polls have shown that some members of the evangelical community there continue to have reservations about voting for somebody who's a Mormon. But I think it's become marginalized compared to either what it was 4 years ago or what some people thought it would be this time,
Ryan.
Overall.
Right. Well, I think it'll be less of an issue in the general election because
if he is the nominee.
Right, because I think if you try to think of somebody who would refuse to vote for somebody because of their Mormon faith, that's probably going to overlap pretty strongly with people who think the president is a Muslim. And so if they had to pick then between the different religions that they're opposed to, they'll probably pick Mormonism over Islam.
And I would say, I think, frankly, it's kind of sad in a way that we're having this debate over faith. I think that most Americans, my bet is most Americans would say that faith should not be a litmus test for the presidency, that we are a country that was founded on freedom of religion.
We thought we got past it.
That's
with John
right.
F. Kennedy.
That's exactly right. And we've had so much discussion of the role of faith, not only with Mitt Romney, but with Michelle Bachmann and Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich and others, and certainly President Obama, that
right.
I think a lot of Americans would like to get to other issues like the economy.
Let's go to Clemson, South Carolina. Good morning, Abel.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to once again be on your show.
Thank you.
I have two quick comments or questions. First, the conservative attack last night, as I listened on the liberal media, it almost caused me to get physically sick. For almost 3 years, we've been chasing this Bertha thing that conservative media has been on President Obama, and Mitt or Newt has had no problem with them attacking President Obama. But all of a sudden, when the media asked him a question about his marriage and the fact that he cheated on his wife, all of a sudden it's a liberal media attack and a conspiracy. That was embarrassing. But my second point is even more important. All I'm hearing from all these candidates is we're going to get rid of Obamacare as their economic plan. What is their economic plan to bring jobs and to solve our economic problem?
I think that's a good question. What do you think, Ryan?
No, absolutely. They usually don't go from step one to step two. They say we're going to get the government all, out of this, but they don't say step two. Well, how is that actually going to create jobs? And we had plenty of deregulation in the 90s and then in the 2000s, and we saw what happened. Things got out of control, and then they collapsed. And I guess I'm just shocked at the shortness of the memories of the memory here. It's like, what are you going to actually do? And how is deregulating even further going to create jobs? How does the government spending money, how does the government putting money into the economy actually make it harder for a business to grow? It doesn't make any sense.
Jerry, have we heard specific plans from any of these candidates about how to turn the economy around?
Well, I think we have, and I think in a sense they've been repeated so much that people have kind of like have forgotten that voters need to come back to this subject. But look, the View, and it's almost universally held among the Republican candidates, there are variations on this theme, but the View is that if you reduce corporate tax rates, you reduce regulation, and you create a lower regulatory burden that will create jobs in a way that they're not being created now, and that if you can figure out along the way how to reduce the deficit so that there's greater sense among business people that they have a certainty ahead about what their tax rates are going to be over time. And by the way, if you also repeal Obamacare, you'll also create more certainty in the business world about what their costs are going to be down the line. All those things will create jobs. Now, you can either agree with that analysis or disagree with the analysis, but I don't think there's a mystery about what the Republican view about how you create jobs is, and I don't think there's a wild discrepancy among the various Republican candidates about that. I think that's kind of the consensus. And as I said, the question of whether you think that's a sufficient answer or not is open to debate, but I don't think it's a case in which they haven't said what they're going to do.
All right, to Munith, Michigan. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Ms. Ream. Thank you for this wonderful show and the opportunity to present. When you discuss the PIPA laws, one of the things that doesn't seem to come into the conversation often enough is the change in the birth cost of prosecution. When somebody has a copyright infringement, it used to be they went after the court indictments themselves and they had to cost of protecting their copyright themselves. With the digital acts, it all seems that the burden is being shifted to somebody other than the person making the money. And I don't understand why the movie or the record industries need Google to carry that part of the burden for them.
Ryan.
Sure, it's not necessarily a matter of need. It's more a matter of want. Hollywood and the content creators will take what they can get. I think, and I don't say this too often, but I think Newt said it well last night. He said we have a patent office and we have copyright laws, and the system is relatively fine as it is. If you feel like you've been infringed upon, then you can use the laws that are currently on the books and go after these folks. The content creators would like more, and it's under our current system, it's certainly their right to lobby for more.
And interestingly, we've just seen in the news federal authorities shutting down this mega upload site, charging that it illegally shared movies, television shows, and e-books. This was a Justice Department prosecution, sort of the old-fashioned way, not the way that the SOPA and the PIPA laws would propose, but just old-fashioned, go out, get some search warrants, investigate, and the Justice Department cracked down and shut this site down.
Jerry, we've just heard that the Supreme Court has thrown out electoral maps drawn by federal judges in Texas that favored minorities, the unsigned opinion today left the fate of Texas April primaries unclear. Is this a victory for the GOP?
It is, but it's not, I'm not sure that it's going to clarify where Texas goes from here. I mean, what happened was that there was a map drawn up. It was seen to be not fair to particularly Hispanics and other minority groups. The courts redrew the map. The state took it to the Supreme Court and challenged the court-drawn map, and the Supreme Court now seems to have thrown that out. It would suggest to me that this means you go back to the map as the state legislature wanted to draw it, and that is a victory for Republicans. But you know, they're one of the problems is it's late in the game now. I don't know how you handle a primary that quickly, and particularly when nobody is quite sure what their congressional district for a House race is really going to be. I mean, I think that's an element of uncertainty. Texas doesn't have a huge role in the Republican presidential primary, so in that front, it doesn't matter very much. But it's going to be hard to figure out it'll get sorted out. But it's not clear right now what the Texas political map is going
right,
to be like.
To Sarasota, Florida. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you. One thing I never ever hear anywhere on the media is the fact that so many economists were predicting 25% unemployment when Obama took office. You never hear a word about this, and yet you constantly hear attacks against Obama because unemployment got all the way down to 9%. I think he should be praised for the unemployment being 9%.
And Ryan.
Sure. The problem for the president is that it's always hard to take credit for things that didn't happen. And he's been actually mocked by his Republican opponents for saying things could be worse because, you know, frankly, that doesn't help somebody who's out of a job. But the caller is exactly right. And one of the president's problems and a lot of the economic forecasters' problems was that they didn't seem to recognize that this was a different recession than every other recession we'd had since World War II. They were using CBO models that assumed that the financial system would bounce back, or that we basically had a functioning financial system. And if you would throw out that assumption, then you would have seen that unemployment would have gone much higher than it actually did. You know, the CBO and the White House was predicting 8.5%, and it would shot past that within a couple months.
Ryan Grimm, The Huffington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To Silver Spring, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to continue the discussion about the economic impact of the PIPA laws. And, you know, I got an opportunity to hear Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia on the Democracy Now! Radio program, and while he concentrated on the freedom of speech and censorship issues, which may be the most important, he also talked about the fact that the law might have huge effect for especially internet companies like his own nonprofit companies in terms of having to do the policing. And a question of whether this is really laws that would in fact affect media consolidation, putting more power in the large media organizations controlling the internet and really hurting smaller, lower-income groups.
Jerry.
Well, look, I think that there's a kind of an internet culture debate that's woven into all of this, which is there is a kind of a sense that whatever you can get away with online should be okay, and that nobody's really responsible for that. And if you're a content producer, the idea that somebody else would pave the way for theft, which is kind of what this looks like to a content producer, is kind of a ridiculous proposition. And that if something needs to be done to stop the people who are facilitating theft, then that's a reasonable thing to do. That cuts against the internet culture, which is essentially an everything and anything goes culture. And that's, in a way, this is not a legal argument. This is a culture clash. And that's what we're seeing played out right in front of us.
One more issue that's come up this week in Wisconsin. The opposition turned in nearly twice as many signatures as needed for a recall of the governor. What happens next, Cheryl?
Well, what happens next is those signatures will have to be certified. They needed 540,000 signatures. They turned in 1 million. It looks like that's enough to force a recall election, which would happen sometime in late spring or early summer if there's no legal fight. Scott Walker, you might remember, took on the unions in Wisconsin, went after their collective bargaining rights. There were huge protests in the Capitol and Madison. 14 members of the state legislature fled to avoid voting on this law that ultimately passed. It was struck down. There were recall elections. It's a whole saga. It's like a telenovela or something. And there were recall elections in which a couple of lawmakers were recalled. And now we will see what happens to Scott Walker as a result.
Sure. Well, Democrats and labor have two challenges that they face here. And the first is that Scott Walker is amazingly well-funded. He has a personal war chest that's quite substantial, and he's going to get extraordinary amounts of outside corporate money. Because this has become a national a race of national interest, and the elements of the conservative movement that are backing Walker don't want to see him beaten. The second because of the point that it would make. The second problem that they have though is that they don't yet have a candidate. Russ Feingold has ruled out a race. They very strongly pushed him, but he's just said no. I'm just simply not going to do it. Tom Barrett ran against him last time and might be the person that they end up going with this time. But that is a problem because you need a horse to ride if you're going to win this race.
And speaking of horses to ride, today is January 20. I remind you that the inauguration of our new or existing president is 1 year from today. Thank you all so much, Jerry Seib, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Ryan Grimm. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot.